once again, Paul Rodell back on the road. I had a nice week, 10 days off, you know?
Oh, did you really?
Yeah. And today is the 16th of August. And I'm here with Richard Augsburger, in his office in West Van Buren Street. Richard was in IVS in Laos 1966 to 69, first year in rural development, and then the following 2 years as the associate chief of party in Vientiane. So that was 67, 69, under Bob Lovin, who was there at the time. So, as I said before turning on the tape recorder, we've asked people just to tell us a little bit of background about themselves that we did not have room for in a short four-page form. When and where you were born, what were your parents like? You know, what did they do for a living? How did they raise you and your siblings? The influences that made you, to get you up to discovering and that there is such a thing as IVS and why you wanted to join.
Okay.
Yeah. So now I just shut up, hopefully.
All right. Well, you ask whatever you want, Paul. I'm delighted to cooperate on this. Some of those phones I'm going to pick up, but I'll ignore this one. I was born in Trenton, New Jersey, but grew up on a farm in southeast Pennsylvania, Bucks County, Yardley, for 6 years, and then at six, the family moved to Ohio, where my father was a general farmer, dairy farm, some swine, corn, beans, alfalfa, oats, wheat, that sort of thing. 150 acres, so not a big farm. And him buying the
Quite
farm,
diverse, though.
Him buying the farm was a big undertaking for him, because the farm was in my mother's family, and he bought it from her folks. I'm middle child of three. I have an older brother who's 5 years older, and a younger sister who's 4 years younger, and they're both still farming in Ohio, and that kind of gave me the freedom to do some other things. So I'm the gallivanter that trots around the world and does other things and goes back there to visit. Three big influences probably, Paul. Farm, obviously, was one of those. But in addition to farm, 4-H and church were other influences for me. 4-H, I'm a fairly gregarious guy, and so the farm was understimulating to me, and I kept looking to meet other people. So 4-H was a great way to do this. I went to one camp, I think 17 different times, from camper to counselor to eventually staff, and then would go back there for leadership camps from national and state kinds of things, leadership. Church, Protestant, Christian. My father was, both were college educated, mother and father were.
Oh, really?
Both went to Ohio State. No, he went to Ohio State and graduated in agricultural management. And my mother went to Miami, Ohio, of Ohio, and I guess, I don't know if it was home, I think it was home.
Okay.
So, someone needed to go to college in my family. and I wanted to. My sister did airline reservations and then married a farmer, and my brother did, he was more of a plasterer and a
like tradesman. Work with his hands.
Yeah. Yeah. And then eventually went back into farming. So the church influence was, it's watch what I do, not what I say. My dad was more of a quieter man in the sense of, and we'd go visit family and friends and neighborhood on Sunday, and I'd go along. So it was kind of like applied anthropology, you know, you just go along as a youngster and you learn how to do this. So,
what denomination was it?
United Church of Christ.
United Church of Christ, okay. Yeah.
Old Evangelical and Reform, which is more in the German Lutheran tradition.
Okay.
So they're Mennonites and German Lutherans in my background too.
Okay. But not specifically Mennonite for yourself.
No, but there were a lot of Amish and Mennonite in Ohio where I grew up, and we didn't know them, but we played football against them, and we differences and dressing differently. Mm-hmm. So I think that was the first awareness of cultural differences in a sense. Because I was in a pretty WASPy ghetto in central Ohio. Went to college at Ohio State and studied vocational agriculture to be a teacher. I was bored with that before I graduated, but knew I wanted to work with people intensively rather than, I think it was teaching electric to my, when I was student teaching, helped me realize I do not want to be teaching electricity. I'd rather be doing something more people intensive.
Yeah.
When I was in college at Ohio State, I applied for the IFE, which is a 4-H International Farm Youth, that's now International Foreign Youth Exchange, and I went to Sri Lanka.
Foreign Youth Exchange.
Yeah. 4-H mottos are head, heart, hands, and health, the kind of value system. So I applied for IFE, and IFE is a nationwide 4-H program that would send like 50 Americans overseas and do a swap. Those countries would then send volunteers to this country. And in 61, actually, before I applied, we had a German farmer who stayed with us. And it was a wonderful relationship, and we've been family friends. We visited there in New Jersey. One of those, you know, really tough. So the principles of IFE, of increasing international understanding, actually were working in our family, in our community. And that was the first plant seed that got planted, I think, of, gee, maybe here's a way I can go overseas, although I didn't know at the time that I wanted to do that. When I was selected for IFE, I wanted to go to Africa, and Sri Lanka was the place where I went. I got some language instruction, could not speak Sinhalese, but spent 7 months in Ceylon, Sri Lanka, the island off the tip of India, in the summer of 64, summer and fall. Lived with too many, 17 different Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, Christian families. There was one other American person, a girl from Delaware, and we were separate, and that was our IFE exchange. And then coming back, we'd do public speaking and fundraising. We'd explain about the culture and do narrated slide presentations to explain the culture and also to solicit funds for subsequent IFE volunteers. And part of my debriefing, and this was at the 4-H Center in Chevy Chase, Maryland, outside of Washington, part of the debriefing coming back from Sri Lanka was IVF. IVS was at the 4-H National Center for some reason and said, if you ever want to go back overseas, we do that sort of thing, give us a call. And I didn't forget that. So
somebody
was
smart
connected there. And yeah, and
smart recruiting.
Yeah, it was a good opportunity to catch people. You know, we're still enamored with the culture generally.
Yeah.
We're
You're
not quite sure
back.
We want to be back in this culture.
Yeah.
Seeing
and
if they're spray cans and mass market supermarkets and all that dehumanization.
Yeah. Anyway. And if you're really happy to get back, well, you're only one out of the other 50. Yeah.
So I took longer to graduate because that was a 6-month hiatus in the middle of college. I also played lacrosse in high school, in college. I don't know. I mean, being physically active is important to me. So if you're talking about influences, sports and a coach, two people were probably, my mother died in an automobile accident in 65, and I graduated from college in 66. So two people were disproportionately significant to me there. One was the national 4-H leader, a woman by the name of B. Cleveland, and the lacrosse coach, Paul Hartman, who, you know, saw potential me that I didn't see. He ended up being an All-American lacrosse and didn't know about the sport except freshman year. So it was a fun, I think I did better in sports than I did academically and in undergrad, but it was a neat group of guys, and I learned to be more physically active.
Well, you're also working with a team.
Yeah.
So that's more of the social skills too.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to feed that to you, as
a
but just it just
I
struck
like
me.
I like working with groups.
Yeah.
As well as some solos.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it was 64 and 65. I was dating a woman by the name of Joanne Augsburger. I met her before I met her before I went to Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
Bought two rings in Sri Lanka. Not sure. I had one date with her. Bought an engagement ring, hoping that maybe it would be for her.
Aren't you confident? Confident. Wow.
Impulsive, I think, is the correct word.
Oh, okay.
So when I came back, I started dating Joanne more seriously. We liked one another. She's an identical twin. And she had thought about Peace Corps, but would never go alone.
What was her maiden name?
Bauman. She's from Southwest Ohio. And we met at Ohio State.
Okay.
She was studying social work and came from a farm. Near her 4-H camp is Augsburger Road. My family relatives originally lived in Southwest Ohio and granary and a lumber mill or some other stuff. And I don't know how that name, the road got named, but it was interesting. She would go down Augsburger Road to go to her 4-H camp, whatever the name of that was.
Yeah.
So as we talked more and discussed politics, religion, social causes, and the Vietnam War was escalating, I started wrestling with what do I want to do with that issue in my life, and originally thought I could be a conscientious objector and either a chaplain or a corpsman in the military, as a medic in the military. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, if I'm opposed to military efforts, I really am not going to be happy in the service. I'll go the full conscientious objector route, and did that and applied for that, and used IVS then as alternative service. Now, my draft board gave me permission to leave the country, but never accepted that as alternative service.
Okay, I was going to ask.
So what I decided was I would go anyway, and I'd fight it if they wanted to fight it and make an issue of it when I got back.
Did they consider you, reclassify you as CO for the draft? Because we could all call ourselves a conscientious objector, but I'm wondering about the legal classification.
Yeah. I don't know, Paul, the answer to that, actually.
All right.
What I know is they didn't call or touch or harass or write letters or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Once I declared that that was my intent, and they signed something that gave me permission to leave the country, but I don't remember if the CO was on that.
Okay.
I really don't know.
Yeah. Because it could have also just been a... 2A, that's what I had for Peace Corps. It's occupational deferment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, they may have done that and realized that you were also going to file this other thing, so not to bother you. You know? Okay.
So
because you weren't really Mennonite per se, or Brethren, or Quaker, which would have
the three peace churches.
Yeah, which would get you
automatic.
Pretty much automatic. Yeah, they sometimes would drag their feet if they had a bitchy local board, but you know, most of them would. Automatic. Okay. Sorry to try to make that distinction and just splitting hairs here.
No, it's important for accuracy. I decided then I wanted to go to Laos with IBS, whether or not Joanne did. I mean, in retrospect, that probably wasn't fair to her. And I think she was faced with the dilemma is if I want to get married to this guy, and we were talking marriage, then I need to go to Laos too.
To be with him.
Yeah, I had initially applied because I knew about IBS through the 4-H liaison.
Right.
And applied and started that and explained my intentions, and then she applied and was accepted also.
Mm-hmm. So were you accepted as Richard Augsburger and then Joanne Barlow, was it?
Bauman. We were accepted as two separate individuals.
Not married yet.
Not married. We were married. She graduated in 66.
Mm-hmm.
I graduated in 65. She graduated in June. We were married August 14th, 30 years ago, last Wednesday.
Okay.
And 10 days later, left for Washington for 8 weeks of language instruction without IVS. So then went as a married. So we're accepted as singles.
Right.
With the knowledge that we were going to get married. and okay. got married.
And this didn't upset them?
No.
Okay, all right.
No. I think they were wanting couples. I think they were thinking there might be more stability with couples than some singles floating around, yeah. but...
Oh, I agree, but I just heard that in early days they kind of frowned
upon
yeah.
marriage.
Yeah.
My sense was they frown more upon getting married when you're there.
Oh,
than
really?
They did
coming
before
in.
Before coming in, but oh. I was not on the inner circles, and I don't know. Those okay. are just impressions.
Well, so, these are only things that other people have said,
yeah.
not
yeah.
policy papers yeah. or statements that I've read or anything like that.
Yeah. So we. We honeymooned, I often say, then, for 3 years in Southeast Asia. It's a great way to deal with the in-laws. You take your bride 11,000 miles away from home. You don't have any in-laws. it's a bad joke. She would not laugh about that. She's from a fairly close family.
Oh, okay.
We did...
But there is some advantage.
Yeah. Yeah, there was.
Yeah.
We did 8 weeks of 8 hours a day language instruction by a... woman who was married to a person in the embassy in Laos in Washington, D.C. We lived at 2400 Pennsylvania Avenue and walked past the White House and Blair House every day downtown near the Capitol to get language instruction and then came back. And could probably, the layman's picked it up, both the writing and the elocution much more quickly, could probably speak 10% and understand 30% of what was said when we got in the country.
Mm-hmm.
It was maybe slightly inflated. And then, because we were working in rural development, worked in the language, I did not have French as a backup, which would help
yeah.
some Laos. We needed to work with agriculture agents, home economics agents, public health agents, and veterinarians,
mm-hmm.
and teachers in their language, and most of it was conducted in Laos. But let me back up. A fun story.
Okay.
One day we were walking by the Blair House and the Laotian flag was flying out front, and we thought, gee, I wonder why this was.
Mm-hmm.
And we debated, and we hadn't seen anything in the paper or in the press, and sure enough, as we walked out, Suvarnabhumi, the Prime Minister,
mm-hmm.
who's very short with his cigar, walked down the street. Unattached, no bodyguards. Yeah, and
oh
we
God.
Were astounded. We were thinking, I think we had been in language instruction 2 or 3 weeks. We were thought, should we say hi to him? But
oh,
we
yeah.
were afraid that we would insult him because we didn't know the proper tones for talking to someone of royalty. And so we just watched and observed quietly and confirmed. Then we saw in the paper that night that it was, in fact, him. We thought it was him from his picture, but we didn't know him.
Uh-huh.
So it was kind of neat to see him in
yes.
Washington.
Yeah.
Went through the Philippines where we had 10 days to 2 weeks
mm-hmm.
of orientation to tropical agriculture, nutrition, growing plants and animals. And that was frustrating because in Philippine culture, you didn't show public displays of affection. Here we are, newlyweds. She was in a girl's dorm. I was in a boy's dorm. We ended up kissing on
yeah.
the campus at Los Baños.
That's right.
You grew up in that, or you spent a long time in that culture. You know about those things.
Yeah, yeah.
When
you were there, did you meet a woman named Sabina Fajardo?
No, but there was another woman who subsequently became either a volunteer or a board member of IDA. It's a similar name, but that was not her name.
Though there was Sabina Fajardo married Steve Swift, Sabina Swift. And
no.
she was a volunteer, and she served in, had been with Operation Brotherhood in Laos, and then was in Los Baños, maybe at the time you passed through.
Okay.
And then went into IVS and served in Dalat.
Oh, really?
And where she met Steve, and then there in Hawaii. Then. I saw them in April when I was out there for a conference and interviewed them, and just got a letter from them the other day. Well, anyway. Yeah. Let me back up for just a second.
Sure.
I forgot if you said when you were born.
I did not say. I was born September 10th, 1943.
Okay, all right. That we're just trying to keep all of those...
53rd.
Yeah, all those things in terms of... And what did your mom do for occupation?
Mom was primarily a housewife, although she went back and did a master's in adult education.
Mm-hmm.
And her employment outside the house was as a librarian for the Delaware County Library.
Okay.
For a few years, she was killed in an automobile accident.
Yes, you mentioned that in 65.
She was handy with her hands and did a lot of artwork. Did a copper tooling of our farm and gave it to this German Giffey that was with us.
Uh-huh.
Gave him one and also made one for the family, so it's been prized among my siblings as a legacy for my
family. Oh, sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Were there other things I should address?
No, that's the only couple of things that I tucked away in my head. Well, I would like to know, though, you had prior experience in Sri Lanka and then Philippines. But when you get to Laos, what are your first impressions?
Dry,
mm-hmm.
arid, poorer than I anticipated. Part of the reason, poorer meaning economically.
Yeah.
Part of the reason I wanted to go back also to Southeast Asia was I was kind of intrigued by Buddhist culture, and Sri Lanka was a very rich Buddhist culture, and I was thinking uh-huh. like, that was not true for Laos. Laos did not have the intelligentsia, did not have the written language or documentation or the libraries that mm-hmm. Sri Lanka had. So it was a fascinating mix of spirit worship and nominal Buddhism in the places where we were.
So poorer not only economically, but in a sense culturally too.
Somewhat. Now, they jokingly said the French kept Laos as their game preserve. So they didn't build roads, they uh-huh. didn't build schools, they didn't build health clinics or dental clinics, those kind of things. And
that may be the wrong way to explain it, but it...
In some respects...
not just as a game preserve, but certainly they didn't do anything to it.
I mean, it had one major road, which was in need of repair, and it didn't go all the way through the
uh-huh.
country. I mean,
uh-huh.
The only way to get to Muang Pin, where we were finally stationed, was either by elephant,
mm-hmm.
or boat, or plane. There was no road.
Yeah.
What else? Hustly, bustly, capital city, Vientiane. We were there in the middle of the dry season, so it was
mm-hmm.
dusty, and it was dry, and there weren't the lush green rice paddy fields. Confusing because... and even after the Philippines, but much more variety of things happening on streets.
Oh, really?
Buffaloes walking across the middle of streets.
Right.
They weren't sacred, they just wandered. And
mm-hmm.
the rickshaws, and then taxis, and some cars, and a lot of bicycles, and a lot of motorcycles.
Taxis, rickshaws, what do you mean by that?
A rickshaw would be, it's like a two-legged taxi.
Mm-hmm.
A person would walk you with a cart behind to wherever you
okay.
wanted to go.
Yeah. All right.
I don't know if that's the proper term.
No, it is, but it somehow got twisted in my mind to be like a conveyance along with a motorized.
Yeah, and no, it was.
Thing. This was the human thing.
It's almost like a pony sulky with a person pulling.
Yeah. Okay. I'll pause it.
Okay,
we're back on again. I'll always tell you when this is on and when it's off so that it's not rolling when, you know, you might not expect
it. Or your understanding on the phone, too.
Of course. If we're tapped out, we can move on to other things, or unless you have some other remembrances that you...
In retrospect,
mm-hmm.
We were oblivious. We, Joanne and I, and the rest of the volunteers, and I can't remember how many were in our group, it was a fairly big group, I think, of rural development that all arrived at once. I think there were maybe 15
mm-hmm.
that went through Philippines and arrived.
So, just for Laos?
Yeah.
Okay, because sometimes they were Laos-Vietnam groups combined.
Yeah, ours wasn't, I don't
Okay,
think.
All right.
we were oblivious to how the decisions were being made for placement, and ironically, we're fortunate to have a very secure, meaning dangerous, non-dangerous, placement in military.
Physically secure.
Physically and militarily and geographically. So some of our colleagues were not nearly as fortunate. The laymans were not as fortunate, and others that didn't make it home were obviously less fortunate. So I think we're thankful in a sense that where we got placed, there was a Peace Corps guy in the town, George Reidenauer.
He had been IBS.
And his wife Nancy.
Right.
So they were glad to have some IBSers in town with them, and it was a significant, secure valley where the national effort was to do a lot of rice production. Laos was a rice importing country, and they had the water, and they had some of the dams, and they were building more dams in this valley to kind of make it a breadbasket, so that the trade for Laos could be improved by growing more rice instead of importing so much.
Were they, just to make a quick distinction, were they aiming only for self-sufficiency or for the export?
Well, they were aiming for market exports.
Really, that much?
They were. I mean, because the Green Revolution was in full swing. It was the early stages of that. The Ford and Rockefeller money came out of the Philippines. And these are the miracle rice varieties that would grow four times as much on the same space. Well, an interesting study in East and West here, of course, these agrarian Laotian farmers, once they realized that, they were oriented towards growing enough rice to fill the basket, the rice basket on their back porch to feed their family for a year, not selling. And so they plant one-fourth the land and work less hard because there weren't the roads and the markets set up to really do the market economy. I don't really know what happened. I don't think Laos ever got self-sufficient.
Probably not.
Until the communists did take over. We were in a lovely wood stilt house. It's like a hard redwood. It was newly built by USAID. It was safe. It was secure. We were in a, it wasn't a provincial capital. We were about a 45-minute jeep ride out of the provincial capital of Sayuri and Montaigne, but it was a Naidan capital. It was the head center for several villages, and the village chief lived right next door to us. And so, obviously, building relationships there was important. Day to day, I worked with three agricultural agents and a veterinarian, and my wife worked with. Should I talk about her in this, or do you want more focus on?
Well, when I read your yellow sheet over, one thing I was going to ask you was to differentiate what you did as opposed to what Joanne did, because you seem to have both mixed in your description. So it would be, you know, you couldn't go into the detail, but she could, but if she was here, but nonetheless.
She worked with home economics agents and medical people, nurse midwives to help on nutrition and sewing and birthing of children, and those were her, and we had Laotian counterparts that we worked side by side with. So one of the early awarenesses for me was my job was really more on the job training of the Laotian agriculture, veterinarian, public health workers than it was directly working with the Laotians.
The farmers themselves.
Yeah, and that was a little bit of a disappointment, although you could do both. And as my language, I needed to initially because I wasn't communicating, but it was this strange looking, tall, blonde, and fair skinned guy. And what's he doing here, anyways? He worked in the military a lot. We worked for a year, and I don't know all the reasons. Then IBS wanted me to consider the supervisory position, associate chief.
So they approached you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I mean, they approached me and I was interested. I didn't think we'd been in the village long enough, a year, not mm-hmm. enough time.
Enough time for what? To be effective there?
Yeah, to enough time to see tangible results of
okay.
progress, whether it's fish ponds or fish production or rice, or twice a year illnesses would wipe out either the chicken or the buffalo population that would devastate these farmers that were fairly poor, and if they had one buffalo, it was their work supply, and if they lost a buffalo, they're out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
Or to see more farmers participating in the government programs where they get free rice and insecticides and fertilizer, which, and they needed to know how to calibrate. I mean, these are people that did not know this. Average was 2 years of high school, 2 years of schooling,
mm-hmm.
and not, so they didn't have
a
scientific understanding around. Yeah. One illustration that Joanne used to teach them how to make patterns and sew. And they never had used a tape measure, so they'd use string or anything. It didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what inches or centimeters were. It just was a certain length. And like the rice story, the women would make one blouse for themselves and one for their daughter or sister and then stop. They weren't interested in the economic motive to make enough blouses to sell for others.
Well, maybe they also couldn't reach a market, too.
Yeah, yeah. It was not, it was a pre-scientific and a pre-market economy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about the Ridenhours, because you knew them.
Yes, they were neighbors across the street. They had a
yeah.
similar house.
And he, by then, would have been AID?
He was AID.
Okay, and she was no longer IVS.
I think she was a volunteer and they married. I don't remember those details.
Okay.
She was then a spouse of a USAID person, but wanting to be involved in economic activities.
Yeah, no, I spoke to her.
Okay.
And saw her in Ithaca, New York, and she was actually a little bit bitter. She thought it was Walter Cloward, or Coward, I think. I think that was her supervisor at the time. Maybe I've got the wrong supervisor. Who made the decision that because she was marrying somebody who was AID, that she could no longer be IVS, even though he had been IVS, and he was about as close to IVS as any AID was ever going to be. And she was really, she's bitter about that too, down to
yeah.
today. You know.
She was bitter at the time.
Okay. And I wondered if, you
she
know,
was
if
bitter,
you had
but
any...
But I didn't know about what all the issues were.
Yeah. Well, I'm not really clear on them either, because I've only spoken to her and I can't speak to him. That is not George, but the...
Oh, Howard.
Yeah.
I only know that name. I did not know
yeah.
Howard.
Yeah. So I was only seeing if, gee, if you're neighbors, maybe you heard stuff, you know, or maybe you know stuff. But unfortunately, you don't. So that was one of my pre-interview questions that I had. But you accepted the job, though.
I think I did a preliminary thing. I think they asked me to go back to Los Banos and to meet a crowd and to
uh-huh.
kind of bring them into the country.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that was a trial they were watching me. I accepted the job.
I suspect they probably were watching.
Yeah, I had thought about foreign service as a career.
Mm-hmm.
Thought about diplomatic service as a career, and I thought Bien-Chen might be a way to see the organization of IDS from a more holistic perspective, and also bump into more aid and whoever else was in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Political side. And so did not regret that decision. I think they then wanted to figure out a role because they didn't want to split Joanne and I. What's a role for her? And so they put her into a national supervisory position with Lausch and head of home economics.
Oh, okay.
And she could serve some of that liaison purpose with IBS as well. Although she did not have that IBS. I mean the title.
Yeah. No, thinking about asking you what Joanne had to say about the move.
She had most to say, and in retrospect, I would have done this differently. We went from a 1-year contract to a 3-year contract with no home leave.
Ooh.
And she was fairly close. I think the third Christmas in Laos, she thought she was never coming home.
Yeah.
And missed family deeply. And in retrospect, I wish we would have said, hey, we'll do this, but give us a break, an extended break, a furlough, and we'll come back and come to couch. But there were needs to be moving, I'm sure.
Well, it was a reasonable request.
Yeah.
When I extended in Peace Corps to a third year, they gave me the trip home.
Yeah. And we hadn't for illness and other things.
Sure. Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, of course. Bob Lovin was a good boss to work with. He did the overall organizational and USAID and whoever else he dealt with in the board in Washington, D.C. And I really became the chief. Well, I had 30 volunteers in the southern half of Laos, from Vientiane, Prakse, Sayuburi, Savannakhet, not Sayuburi, down.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know, 30 to 50 percent of the time, I was on the road flying and going to do site visits with the volunteers and their counterparts in Laos. And some of that was troubleshooting with staff and...
Laotian staff,
yes. So I would meet with the Lao counterparts or the provincial ag and veterinary people that the volunteers were working with one way or another. They probably were working with one level down. Villages. And one volunteer that who will not be named, I mean, who in retrospect I remember as teaching me a lot about what I didn't know in supervision, he was lying, he was bouncing checks, and we said to him, you either need to tell the truth and stop bouncing checks or we're going to send you home.
Uh-huh.
And, I think he stopped mostly, and I don't think we sent him home at least in the time I was there. But it was then I realized that if I wanted to work more intensely with people, I needed more training. And so I got interested. Two things, I think, that were happening there. And I'm kind of skipping over a lot of those 2 years.
We'll come back.
Okay.
Yeah.
In Vientiane, and we lived in a compound outside. It was relatively safe. It was a...
The 12 or 6?
Yeah. 12 or 6 or 9, I can't remember.
9 is Dundalk.
Okay,
the school.
No, okay, 6.
Yeah.
You have a good knowledge of this.
Well, I've seen a lot of people.
We were on the outside of the compound. We were
okay.
In the house on the outside. But
okay.
We were close enough to enjoy some of the security. Looking at the USAID families, I could see the advantage of working for the Foreign Service was you had acquaintances all around the world and traveled extensively. You had no roots.
Right.
And I, being a Midwesterner, wanted more roots. And I think that was one of the issues that tugged at me to want to come back and not get into this as a lifestyle. I mean...
Come back to the United States, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a decision to not pursue Foreign Service as a career.
Mm-hmm.
The money was good, it was tax-free, it was pretty exhilarating, and Laos at that time, the ambassador was key in deciding where the Vietnam talks were going to be held, and the size of the table, and shape, and all that sort of thing, the way you saw them. And so there was a lot happening there on a mega scale that was exciting and not too dangerous. The other thing is this one volunteer taught me that if I was going to work more intensely with people, I needed more training. So out of the rice paddies of Southeast Asia, I picked Garrett Seminary and Northwestern University to come back and do graduate work in theology. I had wanted to rethink some of the theology I had tossed out when my mother was killed, being bitter and angry, and rethink some of that and re-embrace it, and also study psych to learn how to work more intensively, and so did that.
Those are valuable long-term lessons.
Yeah, they were. I learned lots of useful things in my career. Board and staff were generally supportive, and Dr. Kitagawa was on the board, was a key person.
Who was he?
He, Joseph Kitagawa, I don't know a lot about him, but he came to the country and he listened to us as volunteers and staff, and was doing troubleshooting, I think, for IBS, and then go back and give reports. But this is a man who had compassion. I don't even really know how he spent his professional life, but he had an understanding of culture diversity and appreciating differences and the value of what we were doing and the needs that we could have. So he was like a voice to go back to.
When did he come
over? Or Washington. I'm blurry on the dates. I think it must.
Had to have been after 67.
Why?
Because you were still in the field, 66, 67.
See, I don't know. I was just going to say, I don't know if it was before or after I became the AG.
All right. Okay.
It may have been after, because maybe that was an opportunity to work more closely with him and learn what he was doing, because that was partly my job as associate chief of party, is going around visiting
and doing troubleshooting.
Brainstorming, yeah, and trying to be an advocate for the Laotian government, for IBS, and to keep the autonomy and integrity of the organization apart from the 80% effort in Laos, which was military and non-economic. They used to say, we're here to do economic, but underneath the surface, 20% of their, the whole U.S. effort, of which IBS was part, was economic, and 80% was military. And that was distressing and upsetting for me to learn.
When did you learn?
The first time I learned was, I was in Savannakhet one day, and the rules were in, and it may be true in all countries, when an American came to the country, they needed to register with the embassy, and they were escorted around the country. And so all of the, quote, clandestine illegal activity that was happening every day on the streets in all those towns stopped. And so, like, the traffic, the army trucks and the jeeps, all that stuff was gone. It was like a normal lazy village instead of a military town. And then I realized, they called them the spooks. I mean, the other various agencies that were very much present in Laos, because we were there fighting the prototype hidden war that even Senator Fulbright did not know about, and was furious himself when he found out exactly what was going on. I think once I was aware of how town life changed when there were other, when there were official Americans, I was really unofficial, because I was more like a local than a part of the diplomatic corps in most ways. In other ways, we were all part of the Western effort. And then when we would do R&R, and we could use Air America flights to go to Bangkok or to Pattaya and other places, which were great places to visit, we would talk with military and they'd say, you're where and you're doing what? I mean, you're stationed on the ground in Laos. They were always told that that was off limits and they couldn't be there. Well, what I later learned was all the people that worked illegally in Laos were officially stationed in Thailand, and they'd just come across the river. The Mekong River divided the two countries, they had a whole southern half. And they'd work all day long in Laos and then go back.
Supposedly.
Yeah. And they didn't know it, because there were big houses that they operated.
Yeah. But you learned this when you were in, took a trip to Savannakhet, not when you were in Vientiane.
Yeah. Vientiane, there was a 50-mile radius. You couldn't fly U.S. aircraft, military bombers over. it was like a circle of non-intervention. And so you wouldn't know in Laos, in Vientiane, the level of activity that was going on in the villages, and a lot of that was up north, the Plain of Jars and all the heavy military, or Udon and Ubon, where the B-52 strips were. And another lesson I learned in Sabanacat, once I was aware of this difference of activity on the street levels, one day I was up early, I always get up early, eating Vietnamese breakfast, which is hot Ovaltine with a raw egg mixed in it on a local breakfast spot, and I noticed the windows and the glass in the windows was rattling, and there weren't many glass windows.
Mm-hmm.
And when I paid attention to that, I thought, there's a thunderstorm. And then I thought more, and I thought, this is not a thunderstorm, this is constant, this is B-52. And this was post-68, post-TET, and they just, we were pouring all of the same flights that used to fly north of the 19th parallel or whatever, 70, into the Ho Chi Minh Trail, half of which was in Laos. And
yeah.
So literally 30 miles east of where I was sitting,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't hear bombs per se, but I could. It was enough that it sounded
but there
like,
were tremors.
Yeah. It would rattle windows, and once I paid attention to it, was more aware of it, I could hear the bombing. It was just constant, 24 hours a day.
So
those, I think, and then we would occasionally get in Time or Newsweek and read, you know, if there were an incident in the country and nothing specific comes to mind, we know what happened, at least in country, and then we read about it, and it's like, this isn't the same thing. It kind of... Those were clues. The activity level in the street, the bombing noise in the background, and the discrepancies in reporting that there's something else going on here that we have no awareness of. And so then we began kind of getting curious about it.
Mm-hmm.
Not intentionally looking at it. One of my favorite activities, I think, was Peter, and I can't remember in the embassy, the political officer in the embassy would want to talk with me when I'd come back from these rural trips.
You mentioned that you'd always, that there would be embassy people who always wanted to debrief you.
Yeah. And Peter I liked. He was a bright Yalie. He seemed to respect what we were doing. And later I learned that he was just debriefing, and some of that stuff would be classified, and if I needed to know it, I could read it. But often, what I would say would be classified, and I wouldn't even have access to it. And I didn't understand that, and you know, there were so many agencies gathering data, duplicative, triplicative, of the same kind of phenomenon. I was just grateful that every morning and night, both when I was in Mon Ping and in the field, that I knew to check the radio morning and night and find out what's the best read of security so we knew whether or not it was safe to travel. But some of those roads were where there were enemies crossing.
Even in your first assignment?
Not in the first assignment.
Okay.
Mon Ping was a secure battle. Now,
okay.
They strategically, this was another eye-opener. It's interesting, before I opened it. They trucked in and helicoptered in Muong refugees.
Mm-hmm.
These were essentially nomadic people from the mountains, strategically placed in lowland areas to teach them how to grow paddy rice, and when they're used to the slash and burn agriculture. But they did it politically because they were fairly staunch anti-communists, and they would place them strategically, and they would die like flies of malaria because they weren't used to the lowland areas, and they had to learn a whole new way of agriculture. I felt badly that people could be placed for political reasons whether or not it was in their best interest. There's another early cue, I think, that something bigger here is going on.
Mm-hmm.
But so I think I enjoyed working with them. They were very industrious. They had no written language. They had a value system more like mine, work hard, grow crops, and they were more entrepreneurial. They would grow things and they would sell pigs,
mm-hmm.
and they brought pork into the market for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a little break.
Okay. Turn this back on again after the telephone and bathroom break. You're following up something that I find very interesting.
The refugee piece and...
Well, that was put in the growing awareness and the fact that people could function and work in a country without knowing all of what's going on, and how you had to gradually put pieces together.
Yeah, I think, I mean, being a conscientious objector, I wanted to be open, and on R&R we would talk with hawkish military types, and they were so frustrated under the dullest influence that they couldn't just go in there and wipe out the bad guys, the communists. And that was stuff that I wouldn't hear either, I mean, because I would be on the other end of that. It's like, to me, if we could teach people how to grow rice and vegetables and keep them healthy and educate them, that was the most significant anti-communist activity you could do.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be cheaper and you wouldn't have to kill anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But that was fairly naive in the big scheme of things. And because I thought if you feed them and give them land and teach them how to be healthy, they would be supported.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hmong were tragedy. Because the West said to them, if you don't cooperate with us, we're going to bomb your villages. And Pathet Lao in the East said, if you don't cooperate, we're going to kill your village leaders and burn your villages. And they were essentially apolitical. They just wanted to do their slash and burn agricultural mountains and live their lives. Well, they kept getting, they were really like chess, like players on chessboard. They kept getting moved. That was very disconcerting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I was grateful one day that the military were there, because I was on a lonely stretch of land between Savannakhet and Pak Seh. I was north of Savannakhet. And we were told to never be on the roads after dusk, and that was smart.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I came across, the bridge had been bombed out. This is a major tributary to the Mekong River, north of Savannakhet. When I came off the ferry, which was an army boat, I had two flat tires, and I wasn't going anywhere. So I was carrying a ground-to-air radio, which they told me I needed to carry. And eventually, they said I should carry a weapon, and that was a struggle. I carried a pistol. Never used it except at target practice in case, well, others would say if you need to shoot a squirrel or a rabbit if you're dropped in the jungle, but probably for enemy, but I wouldn't have a clue what to do. Coming off this bridge, I tried to use my ground air radio and to get some help because I needed to get out of there quickly. Let me get this. Excuse me.
Okay. It was important to her. Yeah. So we're back on. I just put it back on again.
I started talking to this ground air radio, and somebody answered, American.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, what are your coordinates? Well, I didn't have a clue what coordinates were, because I had been briefed on it. I wasn't carrying them. And after about a half an hour, they said, I'll tell you what, we're going to, and I said, I'm at the major tributary, the major river in Laos, mm-hmm. Vietnam. Well, that doesn't mean anything if you don't know your coordinates. You ought to be able to find me. So they said, we'll fly towards you, and when you hear us, tell us, and when you can't hear us anymore. So they did this two or three times, and I had images of a B-52, you know, circling over Bay, whatever, Gulf of Vietnam. Anyway, I think it was, they had a lot of turboprop spotter planes that
mm-hmm.
would help
mm-hmm.
the radar stations, the weathermen tell them where to drop bombs. Anyway, after about an hour and a half, a helicopter, a Huey, was right over tree line. It wasn't dusk yet, picked me up. They were very angry at me that I was out there and I didn't have my coordinates, but they said, get in, and they took me back. And I landed in Spoo Kevin. I mean, they didn't drop me back to the USAID compound where we normally would get the GPS. So here I am seeing other parts of town that I didn't know existed, and all the radar, and all the, I mean, it's American life in these compounds. In Savannakhet?
In Savannakhet, okay.
Yeah.
So there was one AID compound and then one CIA compound.
There were several CIA compounds, because there were multiple groups.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All the services were there,
okay.
Gathering intelligence, surgery, and stuff.
Yeah. That would have been an eye-opener to wind up there.
So I am, and they didn't say, don't ever tell anybody where you were. They just said, get your coordinates and carry them with you, your maps, which would be 50 pounds of maps.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I was grateful that day that
yeah.
I was able to get assistance and get back to a safer place. So.
Yeah. Well, but if there hadn't been a war, then you wouldn't have needed them.
Yeah.
And if there was more concentration on Well, never mind. We could go on and on like that. What about, but what was the name of the board member who came to visit that you said?
Joseph Kitagawa.
Kitagawa, okay. Yeah.
I think he was with the World Council of Churches, actually.
Okay. You said that he would listen to volunteers and what they would say, and what their, I don't know if you use this word, I'll say problems, their concerns, whatever. What were some of those things that he was hearing from people?
Well, they tended to be tactical, logistical kinds of things, like we need better language training if you expect us.
Okay.
And we had been blessed with pretty good language training 8 weeks. Not everybody got 8 weeks of training.
Yes, I know.
We need more orientation into tropical agriculture if you expect us to dig wells and grow fish ponds and those kind of things. Basics of we want mail delivered and fresh food, but we don't want to be part of the larger American effort. And how do we keep working at using USAID services and Air America, which is CIA really in retrospect, without selling our souls in a sense, but so provide us good support services in the field, but maintain our integrity and identity separate from it. We don't want to be just doing American policy here. We're here with a mission to help people. So they were generally, I think, those kinds of things.
How widespread was this concern about over-identification or strong identification with the American mission writ large as opposed to an IBS ideal?
I think it was fairly strong. I think it was fairly broad spread, widespread. Majority of IBSers, at least the Americans, and we were mostly American air miles.
Yeah.
Were either conscientious objectors or came out of the peace churches.
Yeah.
I mean, the Mennonite and the Brethren and the Quaker fed this organization. I mean, that's where it was started after the Marshall Plan. I mean, this was a fairly liberal, not strong left consciousness group that was there with a mission to make a difference. And the difference was different than just military domination or killing. I mean, let's see if we can make a difference in the rural areas. So I don't remember huge debates about it. I think it was fairly common among IBSers that they wanted this, and they did not like talking to embassy people. I had to, I felt like. I mean, I didn't know why.
Well, in your position, yeah.
Yeah. And I certainly wanted to do whatever I could if it's going to increase the safety of volunteers, because by that time, we had some volunteers that were ambushed and killed. I visited this one guy once who was way out on the edge, and they just AK-47'd him one night. He was gone.
This was Scheidler?
Yeah.
Was he warned in advance?
I have no direct knowledge that he was warned. I mean, usually he spoke the language fluently. He was well plugged into his community. He may have had clues that there was enemy activity, movements, patrols in his area. I do not know explicitly. I mean, because he knew the local language and the cues, I would guess he may know. But they were also very skilled and deceptive. I mean, they could move wherever they wanted to at will on the ground. We weren't going to drop bombs on one patrol.
Right. Well, did IVS Vientiane suggest that he move out?
You know, I don't know the particulars. I think he... I do not remember the particulars.
Okay. All right. Because sometimes, you know, people might ignore warnings.
Yeah.
Or sometimes they may not get them in time. So, you know, that's what I was trying to figure out there. Because you mentioned that some were lost during your watch. And I assumed that Scheidler was the one. And as soon as you said the shooting...
No, wasn't. It was...
That
Edwards.
Wasn't him?
No, it was... No, I was a short-termer. His crisis was handled, I think, before I was in the ACOP responsibility.
Scheidler?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right.
There was a guy stationed in Adepu, Chandler Edwards is the name that's coming to mind. I don't remember if that's accurate. Who was bazooka'd in his Jeep. And I don't think there was any warning. And I had like 6 weeks to go, and Bob Lovin said, I want you to go down to Poxay and figure out what happened, and I wanted you to call us folks. And my wife said, quietly, in my house, why doesn't Bob Lovin go? I don't want you going down there and the same thing happening to you.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob was about ready to leave. His wife wasn't too pleased about him doing it either. I mean, I ended up going, and it was okay. But again, I saw the Jeep. This was Adipu. It's a strategic mountain in south of Laos. The patrol was in a place where they hadn't been before. It was in a very wide open spot, and they annihilated them. I mean, and there were several locals with him. And so I saw the Jeep, and I talked to people, and I talked to folks, and was able to safely. That was, there were two scary trips. That was one. Was able to communicate them to family the best to my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
What had happened. I don't think Chandler, although both Scheibler and Chandler, I mean, they wouldn't have been in those locations if they weren't risk takers.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think Chandler was self-destructively a risk taker. I mean, I think they ambushed him out of the loop. That was my sense.
Okay. That it was
Scheibler,
just.
I don't know.
Yes. So this other one, Chandler, you're saying.
I think that was it.
Okay.
And this would have been 69. This would have been mm-hmm. close to the time of coming home, and I came home in summer of 69.
Okay. So this would have been early 69. Okay. So about a year after Tet Offensive in Vietnam.
And not far from.
From that area.
From Saigon. I mean, Adipu was.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in retrospect, they wanted it. It was high, there weren't many mountains, and it was a great place to observe the southern delta in Vietnam, because it overlooked it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, okay. Yeah, yeah. But it might have been more a case of his being in the wrong place at the right time?
Yeah, it was broad daylight, and
he should have been safer.
Yeah. And it was in an area where there hadn't been any platoon activity before, and no ambushes. So they caught us off guard, and they
yeah, and he paid the price by being there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that thing could happen. Yeah, because you mentioned that you know that there was
Chandler
this loss.
Chandler was good about checking in morning and night. I mean, he wasn't.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he was single. He was a risk taker, but he was not. Naive risk taker. He was following, that was my sense of him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He was trying to do a good job and stay safe.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Again, you know, in retrospect, there were six or eight pockets that were high risk, dangerous.